explosion behind them as a force wave blasted them off their feet. Jason pushed himself up from where he had sprawled in the sand, head ringing from the noise. All he could hear was a rushing sound like the ocean. Kneeling in the sand, he wavered unsteadily. Humphrey tapped his arm and pointed where the elf had gotten back up and continued running. Jason nodded, and after a dizzy false start, followed, picking up his sword from where he'd dropped it. Jason staggered forward, an equally unsteady Humphrey at his side. They caught up to the elf, who had stopped to avoid running into elementals from the other direction. Still unable to hear, Jason felt the air stirring, loose sand flittering along the ground. Looking back the way they had come, he saw a burning orb surrounded by a vortex of air, dragging things into it. Closer to the orb, the suction was clearly more powerful, sucking up the sand elementals as they struggled to escape. Those that were caught up passed through the orb, splattering out the back as gobbets of molten sand. Humphrey tapped Jason on the shoulder again, gesturing the other way. Jason looked to see Phoebe and Gabrielle handling the elementals just fine by themselves. The adventurers fighting back to back were doing less well as elementals converged on them. Jason took a healing potion from his belt, Humphrey doing the same from his own. They each thumbed the stoppers off their vials and drained the contents. Jason's head cleared, the rushing noise in his ears replaced with actual sound. Behind them, they could hear the suction of the vortex. Ahead of them was what sounded like muffled explosions as Phoebe blasted apart elementals with bare-handed special attacks. From Gabrielle's direction was a regular smacking sound as her iron staff burst open more elementals with raw strength.
"Your lady friend is kind of scary," Jason told Humphrey.
"Not the time, Jason," Humphrey said, wings appearing briefly as he used a special attack to leap away. He landed like a grenade near the pair of struggling adventurers, sweeping away elementals. Jason took a couple of steps and used the leaping power of his boots to follow, arriving in the space Humphrey had just cleared.
"You have to make time for relationships," Jason said, his sword cutting through an elemental. "Time and communication."
The two adventurers they had come to support went from almost overwhelmed to completely unnecessary. Humphrey and Jason each took a side of the pair and moved around them, clearing out elementals like they were trimming a hedge. Humphrey and Jason had very different fighting styles. Humphrey used strength and the weight of his heavy sword. Solid as a rock, his subtle but crucial footwork was the foundation of his balance as he swung a sword heavier than he was. His sweeping strikes looked simple, but their power and precision were exacting. Jason's style was more like an acrobatic dance. His sword was much smaller, smashing elementals apart not with power, but with the considerable magic it had built up over the fight. The blade flickered in his hand, elementals scattering into clouds of sand on contact. His feet moved just as fast, and not always on the ground. Launching into a spinning leap, his razor whip boots each took down an elemental before he landed, his movement never stopping. The vortex bomb was the tipping point of the battle, letting the group get a handle on the elemental's huge numbers. As the last one fell, the group came together, exhausted. They stood around, hands on knees, or lay down, ignoring the heat of the sand. Jason took out a fruit drink, slurping loudly to the envy of the others. Humphrey shook his head as identical paper cups appeared from his own void storage space.
"Gemberries?"
Jason asked Humphrey, who nodded as he handed one of the large cups to Gabrielle. She gave him a dazzling smile before happily sipping at the juice drink. Phoebe looked around the group with a weary grin. Only the elf and the two adventurers who fought together were injured, and nothing more than bruises. Sand elementals weren't very dangerous individually, at least not ones that small. It was their numbers that made them a threat.
"Now you know why we send such big teams when we go into the dunes," Phoebe told the group.
"That's rough," Jason said, unhappily, shifting uncomfortably on the spot.
"That's really rough."
"We did warn you we would be going into the desert," Phoebe told him.
"What?" Jason asked absently, putting away his drink and taking out a bottle of crystal wash.
"Oh, not that."
He tipped the bottle into his pants.
"I mean, literally rough. I have sand everywhere."
Chapter 80.
It's not work if you love what you do.
After half a day of trudging through the desert, the group finally spotted the Spirit Coin farm. From outside, all that could be seen was a high wall. It was still some distance off, but the group appreciated a landmark in the featureless ocean of sand.
How exactly does a Spirit Coin farm work? Jason asked.
Spirit coins don't grow on trees, do they?
You really don't know?
Mos asked. Mos Cavendish was the elf who fired off the vortex bomb of fire and wind against the sand elementals. The fight had instilled a sense of camaraderie in the group, with Jason acquitting himself well enough to dispel the group's earlier dissatisfaction.
Jason is from another world, Humphrey said. You should get used to explaining things to him.
Another world?
That's right, Jason said.
To answer your question, Humphrey said, spirit coins do not grow on trees.
I guess that would be a spirit coin orchard, Jason said.
Another world, as in a whole other world? Mos asked.
That's right, Jason said.
So where do spirit coins come from?
As in, not this world? Mos asked.
It's an alternate universe, Jason said.
An alternate universe?
It's not that big a deal.
Not that big a deal?
I think you broke Mos, Humphrey said. He's just repeating words now.
Am I ever going to hear about the spirit coins? Jason asked.
They make them out here in the farms, Humphrey said. They have these special molds that cause magic to crystallize. It's a delicate process, though. Changes in the ambient magic can ruin whole batches, which is why they have farms out here. No activity, no life. Very stable ambient magic.
There must be interesting ramifications of pumping more and more coins into the economy, Jason said.
The Magic Society manages all of that, Humphrey explained. It's the main source of their political power, and the reason it's important the Magic Society stays politically neutral.
Like the Adventure Society, Jason said, pointedly.
Yes, Humphrey said. It doesn't always work out that way.
Gabrielle wandered closer to join their conversation.
Did you know that spirit coins are Greenstone's largest export? She asked. Most people think it's the Green Stone, because of the name, but it's actually spirit coins, especially the lesser ones. The farms out here in the desert produce almost 3% of the lesser coins used worldwide.
I did, Humphrey said. Most of these farms are operated by my family or the Mercers, under Magic Society regulation, of course.
Of course, she said, lightly slapping her own head. This coin farm is Geller something, isn't it?
Geller 7, Humphrey said.
How does that work, though? Mos asked. I mean, a whole other world.
Get it together, Mos, Jason said.
Get it together? Your very existence fundamentally reshapes my understanding of reality.
Try going through that while a bunch of people are trying to eat you, Jason said.
Is that some kind of metaphor? Mos asked.
No, Jason said. No, it isn't.
Why is so much of the spirit coin farming done in this region? Wouldn't it be easier to have more localized production?
It's because of the low magic, Gabrielle said. Most areas in the world would have too high a magical density to produce lesser coins. The smallest denomination they can manage is usually iron rank or even bronze rank in highly magical areas.
So why not just make iron coins the basic currency? Jason asked.
They're too valuable, Humphrey said. The values of spirit coins aren't arbitrary. If a farm can produce 1,000 lesser coins at a time, the same size farm could only produce 10 iron coins or 1 bronze coin. And higher ranked coins aren't very useful for everyday life, Gabrielle said. Almost all the magic devices in a home or business run on lesser coins. Lamps, showers, higher rank ones would burn them out.
Some larger infrastructure works on more powerful coins. The loop line, for example.
The conditions in which you can locate a spirit coin farm are hard to come across, Gabrielle added. Finding a low magic area with the kind of stability you get out here in the desert is rare. Somewhere as livable as the Delta, so close to the desert here, is perfect.
Greenstone was founded because it was such a perfect place for low-end spirit coin farms.
Even then, there are no guarantees, Humphrey said. Volatile weather can affect the ambient magic enough to ruin whole batches. Same if a monster spawns nearby, or some adventurer runs around using abilities. That's why we won't be allowed near the spirit coin farm itself. They'll make us wait outside the walls.
How do they stop monster spawns? Jason asked.
They don't, Humphrey said. If one appears too close to a farm, you just have to eat the loss.
So how did you get here? Mos asked.
Do you have some kind of ship that can cross between universes?
Still with this, Mos? Jason asked.
A cannibal summoned me by accident.
Are you just making things up now?
Mos asked. Jason stopped short, his whole body frozen. His face turned pale, visibly shaken.
You got me, Mos, Jason said. I guess I always knew this day would come. This whole thing is an elaborate ruse. I'm actually a failed actor using an array of magical devices to fake being an adventurer from another world.
He shook his wearily hanging head.
Nothing for it now but to walk off into the desert alone.
What is happening right now? Mos asked.
I've no idea what's going on.
Don't worry about him, Mos, Humphrey said. Just remember that if you're talking to Jason and you get confused, he's probably up to something. If you're talking to Jason and you're not confused, then he's definitely up to something.
Well, that's just hurtful, Jason said.
The walls of the Spirit Coin Farm were 5 meters tall, made from yellow desert stone. The gates were small, clearly not designed for a lot of traffic. Outside the gate was a fairly large area of tiled ground, scattered with desert sand. The sole feature of the tiled area was a gazebo, providing shade for adventurers to wait in. It was around an hour after they arrived that Phoebe came back through the gates she had entered alone. She had another person with her as she exited, plus a trio of wagons running behind. These wagons were the non-magical, Heidel-drawn variety, and were longer, wider, and definitely heavier than other wagons Jason had seen. They were all constructed from sturdy metal, to the point of looking like old-timey train cars. Each wagon took 8 Heidels just to move at a crawl. The narrow wheels looked like the exact wrong thing to take onto sand, and the wagons seemed generally useless for desert travel. They stopped in the middle of the tiled expanse, and the adventurers left the gazebo for a closer look.
You're going to like this, Humphrey said to Jason.
Each of the wagons had 2 people on it, who got off and moved around behind them. The back of the wagons folded down into a ramp, down each of which slid a vehicle. They looked a lot like the airboat Jason had ridden on with Clive, and Jason's face lit up with glee.
Some kind of sand boat? He asked.
We call them sand skimmers, Humphrey said. They operate on magic, obviously, so they have to be wagoned out of the farm before charging them up.
Don't want any loose magic in your spirit coin farm, Jason guessed.
Exactly, Humphrey said.
As they drew closer, the people unloading the wagons paused to greet young Master Humphrey. Jason opened his mouth to start off about disproportionate class systems, then stopped himself, shaking his head in self-recrimination.
What is it? Humphrey asked him.
It's nothing.
Really?
Humphrey asked.
Since when do you hold back an opinion?
Humphrey, opening my mouth wide enough to fit my foot in already cost us a healer. It's past time I learned to keep it shut.
It wouldn't be you if you didn't go into a rant about something, Humphrey said. Just let it out.
Jason looked at Humphrey, warily.
Look, Jason said, it's just that you were born as the employer of these people, and they were born to work for you.
Just so you know, Humphrey said, these men earn more money than an iron rank adventurer.
Really?
They work in a giant money workshop, Humphrey said. That makes loyalty important. Also, they have to work in the middle of the desert, which deserves fair compensation.
Do they live out here?
While they're working, yes, Humphrey said. They do stints out here, then go back to their families with all the money they made. After working the farms for a few years, they gain a small part ownership. In our farms, at least. The Mercers don't do it that way.
That's the rub, isn't it? Jason asked. If your family decided to screw these people over and leverage them into working for cheap while using draconian measures to keep them in line, what would stop you?
Basic decency, Humphrey said.
And there's the real problem, Jason said. The line between benevolence and oppression falls wherever your family says it does. That's real power. What happens when Thadwick Mercer is running his family operations?
They wouldn't put him in charge.
His father is grooming him for exactly that. Doesn't say much for his father.
What about Cassandra? Humphrey asked.
She's going full-time adventurer, like her mother, Jason said. Like you, for that matter. Once the next monster surge is done, she's out of here.
How do you know so much about the Mercers? Humphrey asked.
I may have been spending some time with Cassandra. Socially?
I didn't think she had much time for young men, Humphrey said.
Of course she does, Jason said. She just doesn't have time for boys. The workers finished sliding the sand skimmers down from the oversized wagons. The three vehicles were larger than the airboat Jason had been on. They were all flat-bottomed, with a large ring at the back for magic propulsion. There were five seats at the front, one front and center for the driver, with handlebar controls like a jet ski. Behind were four passenger seats, two by two. Between the seats and the propulsion ring bringing up the rear was a flat area for cargo. This space was already filled on all three vehicles with stacked metal crates. The person who had come out of the farm with Phoebe on foot was the bronze-rank adventurer taking charge of the team. It was another member of the Geller family named Ernest. The resemblance to Humphrey was clear, with the same height and broad shoulders. Jason didn't assume a close relation, though, as all the Gellers looked like that. Phoebe was an Amazonian goddess, almost a full head taller than Jason.
If we have these things, Jason asked, looking over a sand skimmer, why did we walk all the way out here?
Because picking you up would be an extra trip to the city for our drivers, and we don't care if you have to walk all the way, Ernest said. We use the skimmers to take coins to the city and bring back supplies. If you want to use one yourself, go buy it.
That's a fantastic idea, Jason said. How much do they cost?
You need the right essence ability to use them, Humphrey said.
Boo!
Jason cheered.
Are you a child? Ernest asked. Mate, we're about to go flying across the desert in giant magic toboggans. If that doesn't eke out any childlike wonder, then you might want to check your soul still in there.
He does have a point, Ern, Phoebe said, patting Ernest on the arm.
Everyone just get on the skimmers, please, Ernest said. He shook his head at Phoebe, who flashed Jason a grin.
Ernest and Phoebe took the first skimmer, while Jason sat behind Humphrey and Gabrielle on the second. Mose and the two remaining adventurers took the last one. Three of the workers who had unloaded the skimmers took the front seat in each vehicle. Jason could sense the presence of a single essence from each driver's aura. A vulture-like bird came swooping out of the sky, then transformed into a sand-colored lizard, flailing its limbs in the air as it fell into Humphrey's arms.
I've had Stash scouting as a bird, Humphrey said. I waved him off when we were fighting the elementals. I didn't want anyone mistaking him for another monster.
My familiar wasn't much good there either, Jason said. Leeches don't eat sand. The driver started feeding spirit coins into a slot next to his seat, and the vehicle powered up with an audible hum. Sigils around the propulsion ring lit up, and the skimmer floated half a meter into the air.
Coin operated, Jason laughed. I love it.
Soon the skimmers were rushing over the desert sand, hot air whipping into the passengers' faces. Like the airboat, the sand skimmer's propulsion rings drew in air from the front to blast out the back. In the arid desert, this dried the eyes out quickly. The drivers all wore goggles, as did Humphrey, who gave an extra pair to Gabrielle.
What happened to bros before hoes?
Jason called out over the blasting air of the propulsion ring.
I don't know what that means, Humphrey called back, but it feels like I should respect you less for having said it.
That's fair, Jason said. As they rushed along, Jason kept from looking forward, to avoid the worst of the dry eye effect.
That made him the first one in the vehicle to spot a fast-moving object approaching from the side. It was another skimmer, but larger than their own. There were at least 8 people aboard, with a canvas awning cover to shade them from the sun. It was veering in on an intercept course. Jason pointed them out to Humphrey, who narrowed his eyes gravely at the approaching vehicle.
"They're after the shipment," he said loudly.
"Sand pirates?" Jason exclaimed with glee, breaking into a wild laugh. He threw his arms jubilantly into the air.
"I love being an adventurer!"
Chapter 81 Crazy Desperation Move. Jason looked around and saw that multiple sand skimmers were converging on the 3 occupied by his group. Compared to their own skimmers, the ones pursuing them were made for passengers rather than cargo, with extra seats and awnings to shield them from the sun. Jason grinned, knowing they were about to pay for the comfort the shade offered them. The other skimmers were also faster, not weighed down by the shipments of coin.
"I can't feel their auras at this distance," Jason called out.
He had to speak loudly over the air rushing through the propulsion ring of the skimmer.
"Me neither," Humphrey said.
Gabrielle, in the seat next to Humphrey, stood up. The speed of the skimmer didn't seem to bother her as she stood solid as a rock, head swiveling around.
8 enemy skimmers," she said. "Each one has 7 or 8 people, most of which have at least 1 essence, with either 1 or 2 iron rankers per skimmer, no bronze rankers."
The team skimmers were running side by side, while the enemy skimmers were closing in on the back and side of their formation.
"Which one do you want?" Jason asked Humphrey.
Humphrey pointed out the pair of skimmers behind them.
"Stash and I will take 1 each," he said.
"I'll take the 2 coming in on our left then," Jason called out.
"Can you get over to them?" Humphrey asked.
"No worries," Jason said, as his cloak appeared around his body. Then the cloak was empty, as Jason appeared under the shade awning of one of the skimmers, where he got his first good look at the pirates. They were human, ethnically distinct from the humans that dominated Greenstone. They looked, to Jason's eyes, more like African natives, with darker skin and wild shocks of curly hair. Jason's sudden appearance in their midst startled the passengers of the enemy skimmer. Before they could react, Jason pushed back the protective sheath on a razor tied to the inside of his forearm. He sliced the back of his hand with it and aimed the shallow cut at the pirates. Leeches sprayed from the wound, scattering over the pirates closely packed together on the skimmer. They immediately went wild with panic. The driver hadn't seen Jason's appearance, only heard his fellows react before feeling a couple of leeches latch onto his skull. This prompted the wild swerving that was noticed by the other nearby skimmer, which moved closer to investigate. As sand pirates screamed panic around him, clutching at leeches crawling onto them, Jason steadied himself by gripping one of the poles that held up the awning. With his other hand, he took out one of his bandolier darts, one with a red cord grip. He saw the second skimmer closing in and tried to gauge its pace as it moved over the sand. Conveniently, it was approaching in a straight line. Jason threw the dart, which struck the sand right in front of the skimmer. It sailed over the dart, which exploded underneath it. There wasn't enough force to do more than superficial damage, but it pushed up the skimmer's back end, tipping the front end down in turn. The front of the skimmer dug into the sand, but the skimmer's speed didn't halt the momentum. The skimmer flipped over, flying through the air before landing upside down. Jason's own skimmer was slowing down as the driver focused on removing leeches from his head and back. Jason used the leaping power of his boots to jump out as his cloak manifested around him. He drifted gently down to the sand. He glanced over at the skimmer haphazardly moving away from him, confident that Team Colin could handle a few sand pirates. He turned his attention to the flipped-over skimmer. The poles that had held up the awning were never designed to hold the skimmer's weight and collapsed. The propulsion ring had warped and was no longer blowing out air, but it maintained enough integrity to prop the skimmer up at an angle. Some of the pirates had been tossed free as the skimmer flipped, and he could see others struggling to crawl out from under it. Jason drew his dagger and moved in to finish them before they recovered.
When Jason teleported away from his team's skimmer, Humphrey stood up, stashed the lizard tucked into one arm. He pointed at one of the skimmers behind them. "Drop," he commanded, then threw the lizard high into the air. Stash turned into a small bird, fluttering in the direction Humphrey had pointed. As the skimmer passed under it, Stash turned from a bird into an enormous sand shab, as large as the skimmer itself. Under the shade awning, the sand pirates didn't see the tiny bird transform into a monster that crashed down on them. They were just pressed into the bottom of the skimmer by a massive unknown weight. The skimmer itself was built for speed rather than heavy cargo, and the magic holding it aloft was overcome. It splashed into the sand, landing flat and heavy so it didn't flip. The propulsion ring whined loudly before cutting out as the skimmer came to an abrupt stop. Stash sat on top of it, his crustacean legs squatting over the sides. The moment he had released Stash into the air, Humphrey turned to Gabrielle. "Protect the skimmer." She nodded, and he teleported away. Instead of putting himself onto a skimmer like Jason, he appeared directly in front of one. He stared at the driver, who glared back, and aimed the skimmer right for him. Humphrey's huge, wing-shaped sword appeared in his hands. Its length was the equal of Humphrey's considerable height, and his feet dug into the sand as he braced to swing its enormous weight. He gathered the power within himself, ready to unleash his strongest special attack. As the skimmer came upon him at speed, he made a huge overhead swing, bringing the blade crashing down. The sword smashed through the awning, through the driver, through two of the pirates behind the driver, through the base of the skimmer, and buried itself in the sand. The skimmer stopped dead. The front half split down the middle and jammed into the ground with the sword. The propulsion ring cut out, and the passengers, dead or alive, were tossed forwards by momentum, sailing past Humphrey to be dumped in the sand. The sword was buried to the hilt in sand, so Humphrey let the magically constructed object disappear. He conjured a new sword into his right hand, this one much smaller. Like his larger sword, it was highly stylized, but instead of a dragon's wing, it looked like that of an angel, the blade assembled from feathers of razor-edged silver and gold. He leveled it at the pirates, groaning where they had fallen in the sand. From their dark skin and wild hair, he could see they were northerners, so he spoke to them in their language. "I am now accepting surrender." The team regrouped after all eight of the attacking skimmers were destroyed. Humphrey and Jason took out two each on their side, while on the other, the bronze rank Ernest had dealt with three. The final pirate skimmer had an encounter with Moses' fire vortex bomb, being reduced to a shattered wreck of warped metal. Jason stood over the bodies of the men he had killed, looking grimly down at them. Sparring with Humphrey and Rufus had given him an inflated opinion of average skill levels, and finishing the pirates who survived the crash had been contemptuously easy. Too easy for taking a life. He tapped a boot to one of them. "Astai Raider has no loot." He made his way to where the other skimmer had drifted to a stop. The pirates were all dead, courtesy of Colin. Where the corpses weren't pale and drained, they were blackened with rot. He cut his hand with the forearm razor, holding it out for the leeches to return. The cut quickly closed afterwards, as if it had never been there at all. The cargo skimmers turned back to pick up Jason, Humphrey, and Ernest, who had all left the skimmers to fight. Humphrey was the last to be picked up, waiting next to the ruins of a skimmer with four prisoners on their knees in front of him. Jason and Gabrielle hopped off the skimmer as it pulled to a stop. Gabrielle moved to Humphrey's side, while Jason examined the wreckage of the pirate skimmer. He could see it had been split down the middle and driven into the ground with a single ludicrous blow. "What did this?" he asked. "Special attack," Humphrey said. "It's called unstoppable force." "I can see why," Jason said. Another skimmer arrived, Ernest and Phoebe stepping off to join the others. "Did you get anything out of them?" Ernest asked, nodding at the pirates. "They're all northerners," Humphrey said. "Astai tribe nomads from the hair and clothes. I have no idea what they're doing this far south, and they aren't talking." "Why would they attack a spirit coin convoy?" Phoebe asked. "If they knew enough to intercept it, then they had to know it would be covered in adventurers.
That's a crazy desperation move.
The four prisoners knelt in the hot sand, glaring up at their captors.
Do they look like beaten men to you?
Ernest asked.
No, Phoebe said.
Could be just courage, Ernest said. But maybe take a look around, Humphrey.
Humphrey nodded, vanishing as he teleported high into the air.
Dragon's wings appeared on his back, holding him aloft as he looked around. From this high, he could see the city and the green of the delta. In the other direction, some of the spirit coin farms. Closer, he saw something moving over the sand. At first glance, he thought it was an enormous monster with three heads. But then he realized it was some kind of highly stylized vehicle. Too big for any monster lower than silver rank. There was a rigidity to its motion. It moved smoothly over the sand, like a humongous sand skimmer. He let himself drop, using his wings to slow down as he neared the ground.
Anything?
Ernest asked.
Sand barge, Humphrey said.
Very big.
We should get ready for another fight.
Chapter 82 Choices.
I like the enthusiasm, Ernest said to Humphrey, but we shouldn't immediately rush to battle. What do you think, Phoebe?
Our options are run or fight, Phoebe said. Their skimmers may have been faster than ours, but there's no way a sand barge would catch us.
What do you think, Humphrey?
Ernest asked.
That barge was larger than any vehicle I've ever seen, Humphrey said. I've heard of the nomad tribe barges, and this was everything promised. I'd be willing to bet their whole tribe is on board.
How would you approach fighting it, then? Ernest asked.
The barge will have their strongest people, Humphrey said. We'll definitely be outnumbered, and we don't have a healer. On the other hand, this first group may well have been trying to drive us into a waiting ambush. If we run, only to fall into the lap of a larger, stronger team, the sand barge will catch us up when we're at our greatest disadvantage. If we're going to fight, it has to be on our terms.
Do you think that's likely? Ernest asked.
I didn't see anyone else from up in the sky, Humphrey said. But a shovel and some canvas sheeting can make you almost invisible out here.
So what action do you suggest?
Ernest asked.
Attack the barge, Humphrey said.
The nomad tribes get by on shock raids with huge numbers and a reputation for atrocity. They think tactics are for cowards and equipment is for the weak.
Humphrey bent down and picked up a claw weapon he had taken from one of the prisoners, holding it up.
They use weapons like this, or even none at all, he said. The nomad tribes are fearsome to an isolated community, but every time I've heard of them coming up against a trained and equipped group, they get torn apart, including this time. Something made them desperate enough to come south and attack a guarded convoy, but that didn't change the result.
Humphrey looked out in the direction the barge was approaching from.
We take the initiative, he said. Put them on the back foot, when they're used to being on the front foot. We move fast, hit hard, and take them apart before they can regroup.
Ernest gave Humphrey an appraising look.
You've changed, Hump, he said. I thought for sure you'd say run.
Humphrey cast a panicked look at Jason, wincing when Jason's face lit up like a child just handed an unexpected present.
Did he just call you Hump?
Jason asked Humphrey.
Humphrey let out a sobbing groan.
Are we doing what Hump suggested? Jason asked Ernest. If we're going to follow Hump's plan the way Hump laid it out, we need to get moving. Don't we, Hump?
I hate you, Humphrey said.
That's all right, Hump, Jason said, with a consoling slap on the back.
If you're quite done, Ernest asked Jason.
Don't worry about me and Hump, Jason said.
Please stop saying Hump, Humphrey begged.
No worries, Hump. I've got your back.
Ernest looked around the group.
Staging an attack like this is outside my purview as team leader. I will not order any of you to participate. If anyone has any thoughts, let's hear them.
Jason smiled to himself. He could see Ernest had already made up his mind and was just creating a teaching moment.
Do we even have time to stand around discussing this? Gabrielle asked.
Humphrey?
Ernest asked. With the speed it was moving, Humphrey said, we have 5 to 10 minutes before the barge gets here.
Do we even know they're with these people?
Mose asked. It sounds like that barge is far away.
We weren't making a straight line back to the city, Ernest said.
That's specifically to avoid interception. They needed fast skimmers to catch us, but they couldn't handle the weight of the coins. The most likely scenario is that the faster skimmers move to intercept us, with the slower barge following to pick up the loot.
That leaves the question of whether we move towards it or away, Humphrey said.
Anyone? Ernest asked. His gaze went over the group, who looked largely uncertain. When no one spoke up, Ernest looked to Jason, who was standing around with a casual lack of concern. He was also older than the other team members, even Ernest himself.
Mr. Asano, Ernest said, what is your assessment?
The instinctive reaction might be to neutralize the threat, Jason said. But that isn't the job. We're not out here to catch pirates or wipe out bandit clans.
That'll be the job they send the next group on. We're here to escort the coins. Attacking an unknown force with unknown capabilities significantly impacts the likelihood of the actual mission going wrong. I say we just get on the skimmers and go.
And if they have an intercepting force? Ernest asked.
Then we handle it, Jason said.
We did handle this lot quickly enough, Phoebe said. We'd most likely handle the next before the barge caught up. I vote we stay on task.
Same here, Mose said. That barge isn't an immediate threat to anyone but us.
That's true, Humphrey acknowledged. The only things out here are the spirit coin farms. Even if there's a whole clan of nomads on that barge, there's no way they'd get past the walls.
Ernest looked around the group again.
All right, he said. Humphrey, I love that you're thinking more actively, but you also have to know when to temper that drive. Everyone back on the skimmers. We're heading for the city.
What about the prisoners? Jason asked.
They're your prisoners, Humphrey, Ernest said. Your decision.
Leave them here, Humphrey said. Let their friends come for them.
The potential interdicting force never appeared, and the skimmers reached a relay station at the edge of the delta without further incident. The coins were loaded from the skimmers to heavy, armored carriages. These were the kind driven by magic rather than drawn by animals. Clive Standish was on hand as the Magic Society representative to inspect the coin boxes for tampering and check the carriages. With him was a team of guards belonging to the Duke of Greenstone. Most essence users in Greenstone were a part of the Adventure Society, but the largest group in Greenstone who weren't was the Duke of Greenstone's household guard. They would be escorting the carriages through the Delta Roads to the city, where the coins would be stored in city-controlled warehouses for distribution and export. The spirit coin trade was the largest source of income in Greenstone, with many of the major local powers involved. The Geller and Mercer families produced the coins. The Adventure Society brought them in from the wilderness. The Duke of Greenstone saw to their dispensation, managed by the Magic Society.
G'day, Clive, Jason said, approaching the Magic Society official.
Good afternoon, Clive greeted, not turning away from his work. He was bent down, checking the underside of a carriage.
What are you doing? Jason asked.
There was an incident several years ago where the carriages were tampered with, Clive said. Some rather sophisticated artifice was used to suborn the magic that drives them. The drivers lost control and the carriages drove themselves away.
That's kind of awesome, Jason said.
I know, right? Clive said, glancing up with a grin. The perpetrator was never caught, which is a shame. I'd love to discuss how they did it. This was before my time, though.
So why bother with all this? Jason asked. Why not just get someone with a storage power to stow the coins and move them?
There have been incidents in the past where the coins that went into the storage weren't the ones that came out, Clive said. It happened enough times in enough coin farms around the world that now everyone uses secure transport crates.
That was a long time ago, Humphrey said. They changed the system here when my mother was still a girl.
Are those skimmer drivers going to be all right to go back? Jason asked.
No, they'll stay until the barge is taken care of, then go back with another escort, just in case. In the meantime, they get some unexpected time at home with their families.
Too bad we didn't have another driver, Jason said. We could have salvaged that intact skimmer for some extra coin.
The only one not destroyed was full of bodies that looked like they'd been out there for weeks, Humphrey said. I wouldn't make someone drive that thing.
Good point. You want to get some juice after this? I'm all out, but Arash said he'd be at the Magic Society campus.
Humphrey leaned in closer, speaking quietly. Actually, I was thinking I could maybe ask Gabrielle, he said nervously.
Clive and Jason shared a glance, and Jason put a hand on Humphrey's shoulder.
Good idea, Jason said.
Go with God, my son.
Humphrey frowned in confusion.
Which God? Do you mean the God of Fertility? The one with all the provocative murals? I'm not looking to take things that far.
Wait, what God is this? Jason asked. Should I be checking out these murals?
Jason wandered into Rufus, Farah, and Gary's suite, crashing down on a comfortable sofa. Farah was at the dining table, which had a half dozen open books on it. She was scribbling in a notebook, occasionally looking up to read a passage or turn a page. She looked consumed in her work, so he didn't interrupt. After a few minutes, Jason heard the sounds of books closing and Farah joined them in the lounge area, dropping into a plush armchair.
The furniture they have here is amazing, she said, luxuriating in the chair. I wonder where they get it.
There's a craftsman out in the Delta, Jason said. He uses all local materials.
How do you know that?
Madame Landry told me, Jason said.
The landlady? Farah asked. How do you get along with people so well when you seem bound and determined to annoy them?
That's rich people, Jason said. Aristocrats and such. Why would I mess with decent, ordinary people? Madame Landry is a small business owner who works very hard to run a quality establishment. I have nothing but respect for that.
But you're a rich person, Farah said.
And am deserving of challenge as such, Jason said. You know, Humphrey took me to task the other day. Once I cooled off, I realized that there was some insight in parts of what he said.
Self-awareness after the fact does seem to be a pattern for you, Farah said. I've been on the receiving end of that myself.
You were right then, too, Jason said wearily. What you said about killing people.
Did something happen on your job today?
We were attacked, Jason said. I killed, I don't know, a dozen people?
How are you taking that?
Better than I'd like, to be honest. It was easy. I don't mean the fighting, although that too, but the killing. It should feel harder, shouldn't it?
Adventurers have to be ready to act without hesitation. Honing that reflex to kill probably isn't good for the soul, but it'll keep you alive.
It's not like I wasn't warned, Jason said. Rufus told me going in there would be a price. When he said that, I thought I could be different, the guy who doesn't kill. It was breathtakingly naive. Now I don't know what to think. How I feel about it doesn't match what I think I should feel about it. I killed people. But if I'm being honest with myself, I had fun today.
Everyone has to find their own balance, Farah said. For me, it's about what is deserved. If I kill someone, then they had it coming. I know you didn't like that we killed those cultists we captured when we cleared out the Vane house, but they definitely had it coming. But that's my answer. You have to find your own.
Jason nodded.
I think, he sighed, I want my choices to make things better rather than worse.
You want to be responsible for your own actions, Farah said.
I can respect that.
I think about Thadwick Mercer more than I should.
Why in the world would you think about him?
I've kind of shown him up a couple of times, Jason said. He's just so witless and malevolent that I don't feel bad about using him. It's very satisfying. But an entitled guy like that, you make him feel even a little powerless, and he'll take it out on the people he has power over. How many members of the Mercer household staff were raked over the coals because I couldn't help getting a few jabs in? What did those offsiders of his have to put up with after Thadwick made them refuse a contract?
I don't imagine your intervention was required to get that boy to treat his people badly.
But expand that out, Jason said. Choices have consequences, and I'm making life and death choices now. How many fathers did I kill today? How many brothers? How many sons?
Farah pushed herself out of the chair and sat next to Jason on the couch.
I think that as long as you keep asking yourself those questions, she said, then you're going to be all right.
They heard laughter coming from outside the room, and the door opened to let in Rufus and Vincent, the Adventure Society official with the enormous mustache. They were both slightly unsteady, and Rufus had a bottle of wine in hand.
Jason, Rufus said, with the happiness of drink. How did the job go?
Well enough.
That's good,
Rufus said. He wandered over to the door to the balcony and went outside, Vincent in tow. Both men were normally more formal, so it was easy to spot the easy intimacy in their body language.
When did that happen? Jason asked.
A while ago, Farah said. You've been keeping yourself busy.
I guess I have, Jason said.
Coming to this city has been good for him, Farah said. He's more relaxed. There aren't as many eyes on him. It's hard to do better when everyone is watching your mistakes.
Good for him, Jason said. You know, I might go call on Cassandra. I could use a night out.
Chapter 83. It makes no difference to the ant. Jason spotted Phoebe Geller as he was walking through the grounds of the Adventure Society campus. She gave him a wave and approached.
There's an expedition being set up to go after that sand barge, she told him after they exchanged greetings. We're going to find out what the Ustai tribe is doing this far south and stop them from raiding any more spirit coin shipments. It's a big group with a silver rank in charge. Want me to get you on the list?
Absolutely.
She flashed him a pretty smile. I'll give Humphrey the details. He'll find you.
I don't doubt it.
They parted ways and Jason entered the administration building. Albert was on the front desk, directing Jason to a part of the building he'd never been in before. He arrived at what looked like an outer office, with an official seated behind a desk next to a door that led further on. The woman at the desk was reading a book, glancing up as Jason came in. She glanced down at a sheet of paper. Mr. Asano, she said with a friendly smile.
That's me.
It shouldn't be long, she said. Please take a seat.
Thanks.
She gestured to a pair of chairs against the wall, one of which was occupied by an attractive young elf woman. Her appearance was quite different from Anissa, who looked like Nazis had grown her in a lab. This elf had the same willowy figure, but tawny skin and vibrant green eyes. Chestnut hair spilled down over her shoulders. Her clothes were in loose fit, local style. Jason had been around enough now to spot the quality make and materials, but they were simple and didn't flaunt their undoubtedly expensive price. She was looking him over in turn, and gave him a smile as he sat down next to her. He had met enough elves by this point to recognize her age at 18 or 19, which meshed with her iron rank aura.
Jason Asano, he said as he sat down.
He offered his hand to the elf, who shook it. I know, she said. I've seen the recording of you taking Rick Geller's team apart.
Jason groaned. I'm not as good as that recording makes out, Jason said. That situation was weighted very heavily in my favor. Also, I don't have evil powers.
She laughed. You went 1-5 with the Geller family team, she said. Some would argue that no situation could be weighted heavily enough.
The circumstances always matter, Jason said. We have a saying where I come from, better lucky than good. Luck has saved my life more than once.
Sounds like an exciting life, she said. I'm Beth Cavendish, by the way.
The excitement is a new development, Jason said. Are you related to Mose Cavendish?
My cousin, she said, nodding at the door next to the desk. I'm waiting for him now. He says good things about you, by the way.
That's very nice of him. Jason said. I was really impressed by that crazy vortex power of his.
He mentioned you were a bit odd,
Something about being from another world. And also cannibals?
That would be the exciting new development I mentioned.
Is that how you became involved with Rufus Remore?
It was, Jason said. You know Rufus?
He conducted my field assessment.
He didn't fail you, did he?
No, she said, with a confident smile. He passed my whole team.
Your whole team? He only gave 6 people a pass, right?
4 of which were my team, she said. The others were those 2 who follow Thadwick Mercer around. Such a waste of talent.
Rufus said the same thing, Jason said.
Is Mose on your team?
No, Beth said. Mose is a little inconsistent to pass a Rufus Remore assessment. He's great when everything is going right, but needs a little help when things get sticky.
The door next to the woman at the desk opened to admit Mose Cavendish into the room, looking rather flustered. Jason and Beth both stood up. Jason, Mose said. G'day, Mose.
You can go in now, Mr. Asano, the woman behind the desk said.
No worries, Jason told her, nodding to Beth. Lovely to meet you, Beth Cavendish, he said. Always a pleasure, Mose. They made quick farewells and Jason went through the door. On the other side was a chamber that looked similar to a nearly empty courtroom. There was a long, high judge's bench, but all the seating for lawyers, prosecutors, plaintiffs, and gallery were replaced with a solitary chair in the center of the room. 3 people were already sitting behind the bench. In the middle was the director of the Adventure Society, the elf, Elspeth Arella. Jason had only spoken with her the once, although he had spotted her from time to time at social events. To her left was Vincent, who Jason had last seen doing the walk of shame from the suite across the hall. To her right was another elf, an elderly woman. All 3 of them were looking at him with blank expressions. Jason looked around, then plopped down in the chair.
We didn't say you could sit,
the elderly elf said. Jason gave her a casual nod of acknowledgement. You're forgiven, he said, her lips thinning as she heard his response.
I have found that people in your position tend to show us respect, the woman said.
And I find people in your position, Jason countered, tend to confuse respect with obedience. Would you rather I come in here acting the way I think you want me to act? He gestured to himself. What you see is what you get. Do you think dishonesty is more respectful than the truth? Vincent was rolling his eyes, while Elspeth Arella's eyes twinkled with amusement. The woman asking the questions remained stony-faced.
How would you rate your performance in the group contract you undertook 2 days ago?
The woman asked. The others still silent. Critically poor.
Explain.
My inability to keep my big mouth shut cost the team 30% of its personnel, including the healer. As such, we engaged in multiple combat situations with crucial absences.
You acknowledge responsibility for the altercation with Thadwick Mercer that led him and his team to refuse the contract at the last minute?
Yes.
Full responsibility?
Yes.
You don't lay any of this on Thadwick Mercer?
Thadwick is what he is, and doesn't know any better. I do, which made it my responsibility to be the bigger person for the sake of team cohesion. Instead, I chose to be small and petty. The woman looked at the other 2. The way they conversed, with glances alone, showed their close working relationship. The woman turned back to Jason.
How would you rate your performance on this mission otherwise?
She asked.
Adequate. Explain.
We encountered multiple combats, and the team handled them effectively. There weren't any shirkers, everyone did their part, myself included.
You argued against eliminating the threat posed by the Ustai tribe.
The job was to deliver coins, not get in a fight against unknown odds.
Overcoming superior numbers is a specialty of yours, is it not?
She asked.
You are aware of a widely disseminated recording of you in the Geller family's Mirage Arena.
If you thought that edited recording was a valid basis on which to assess me, he said, then you wouldn't be qualified to assess me at all. Again, the 3 of them shared a conversation of glances.
You were recently assigned a contract to clear out an infestation of rats in Old City, she asked.
Stone chewer rats, yes.
Your report stated that you killed all the rats.
That isn't accurate, Jason said.
Your report wasn't accurate?
No, your characterization of my report wasn't accurate, he said. My report stated that all the rats were killed, not that they were all killed by me. A number were killed by an additional monster, a rat gorger.
But you are certain all the rats were killed?
Yes.
Why?
I have an ability that helps me keep track of certain aspects of my activities.
What is the nature of this ability?
My own business. They locked eyes as he felt her bronze rank aura press down on him. He held her gaze as his own aura was completely suppressed.
What if I told you that there were still stone chewer rats being found in Old City? She asked.
Two scenarios come to mind as being most likely, Jason said. One would be a second rat colony having spawned. The other would be that you're trying to shake my confidence that the original colony was eliminated fully, which you have not. Jason spotted Vincent nodding to himself.
You did not request a bonus payment after encountering the rat gorger, the woman said.
That's correct.
You haven't requested a bonus for any of the contracts and adventure board notices you have completed, several of which would have certainly been approved.
I'm not concerned with a few spirit coins here or there, Jason said. If I do enough to warrant an awakening stone, I imagine someone will tell me.
You've been undertaking contracts at a rapid pace, the woman said. If not for money, then why?
I've been told I need to get stronger for what is to come.
By Rufus Remore.
He has been telling me to get stronger, Jason said. But I was actually thinking of someone I met at the Temple of Knowledge.
A powerful aura washed over the room, visibly alarming the panel.
Name dropper,
a female voice whispered, somehow both quiet enough to feel intimate and loud enough to fill the chamber.
Do you mind? Jason asked the empty air.
I'm kind of in the middle of a thing here.
With a chuckle, the aura vanished. The three panelists stared wide-eyed at Jason.
Sorry, he apologized with a helpless shrug. She has privacy issues.
Vincent and the elderly elf turned to the director sitting between them.
What is your relationship with the Goddess of Knowledge?
The director asked him, speaking for the first time since he came in.
The same as my relationship with you, Director. She's more powerful than I am. We had a nice chat one time, and she's apparently keeping an eye on me.
You seem unconcerned about having the attention of a goddess, the director said.
You can squash an ant with a boot or by dropping a building on it, Jason said. It makes no difference to the ant. Having her attention is no different to having yours.
You seem to be taking it calmly.
That's a skill I've developed.
Taking things calmly?
No, seeming to.
It's possible I just peed a little.
She looked at him incredulously as Vincent hung his head. The director glanced at the other two. The elderly elf gave a firm nod, while Vincent's was more reluctant.
Approach the bench, please, Mr. Asano, the director said.
Jason stood up and walked over. The bench was high, so the people behind it could look down on anyone standing before it.
Badge, please, the director said.
He took his Adventure Society badge in its leather wallet out from his inventory, reaching up to place it on the bench. The director opened the wallet and touched a black stone to it. He couldn't see what was happening, but she shortly handed it back.
Here you are, she said,
handing back the wallet. He looked down at the badge, where the single star under the Adventure Society emblem had been joined by a second.
A second star means you will be held to a higher standard, the elderly elf said. Don't repeat the kind of mistake you made with Thadwick Mercer.
Call it a lesson learned, he said. From now on, you can take one or two star missions from the jobs hall, Vincent told him. Try not to make an idiot of yourself.
I can do my best with the two-star jobs, Jason said.
but making an idiot of myself is kind of my thing.
Chapter 84 Injury and Death. For the first time, Jason walked past the one-star contracts in the jobs hall to the two-star notices further down. It was a much smaller section, and looking further, he saw the solitary three-star notice board had no jobs at all. Looking over the notices, most were regular monster hunts with some kind of complication. The most common was a requirement to avoid damaging whatever valuable thing the monster had chosen to nest in. Jason frowned as he read a certain contract. He took it from the notice board and over to the desk manned by an Adventure Society functionary he didn't recognize. The man looked over the contract, then up at Jason.
"You aren't allowed to take this contract alone," the man said. "You need a team, minimum three."
"I have some people in mind."
In an old city alleyway, two women struggled to move. One was unharmed but weighed down by the other, who was heavily injured. Her all-black outfit had long, bloody tears across the arms, legs, and torso. The black mask that had originally obscured almost her entire head was ripped, with silver hair spilling out. The uninjured woman was not strong, but she was determined. With her friend draped over her, she kept moving forward. It was daytime, and the alley was close to the Broad Street thoroughfare. They could encounter people at any moment.
"We have to stop this," Belinda said. "It's a miracle we haven't been caught already."
"We keep going,"
Sophie said, her voice strained with the pain.
"If we can play this out long enough, Ventress will be forced to show her hand. Once she does, that gives us options."
"Do you not realize the condition you're in right now? You can barely move."
"But I can move," Sophie said. "The Duke's household guard laid a trap, but now we know to be ready. His bronze rankers can fight, but they can't chase worth a damn.
The Adventure Society has been pressuring the Duke to stay out of it," Belinda said. "I haven't been able to find out why, but it's been good for us. That's over now. The complaints from his High Society friends must have outgrown his unwillingness to push back against the Adventure Society."
"We plan around it," Sophie said.
"Do you even understand how lucky you were to get out of there?"
"This time it was luck. Next time will be preparation.
Next time you'll probably get killed."
"The Duke getting involved buys us time," Sophie said. "Ventress can't accuse us of slacking if we take extra time to adapt. There's only so blatant she can be about setting us up. Whatever she's up to, she won't burn her reputation to get it."
"You do realize she's not the only one trying to set us up now," Belinda said. "The pressure is mounting, and old friends aren't as reliable as they used to be."
They reached a solid metal gate in a high wall. Belinda leaned Sophie against the wall and cautiously pushed on the unlocked gate to peer inside. There were a handful of laborers in the yard, moving materials through a newly made hole in the wall to the yard next door.
"Those adventurers aren't here," she told Sophie. "But there's some kind of construction happening. Just stay there and I'll go get him."
She ducked inside the yard, the workers not looking up as she walked past them and into the back of the clinic. She saw Jory escorting a patient out of his exam room.
"Just apply the salve every morning," he was explaining, "and you shouldn't have any trouble through the day."
"Jory,"
she called out.
"Belinda."
Jory's eyes lit up as he turned around, then narrowed on the blood staining her clothes. He quickly ushered the patient through a doorway.
"Janice," he said through the door. "No new patients for the moment. No one is to come back here until I say otherwise. Understood?" He closed the door and rushed over to her.
"Are you hurt?" "Not my blood," she said. "Sophie is out back."
"Show me."
In an old city restaurant, Jason was served a dish of rice dumplings in the shape of a three-sided pyramid.
"They have this shape because of how they're wrapped in the bamboo leaves to cook," he said, picking up his chopsticks.
"I never could get the hang of chopsticks," Humphrey said, as the waiter placed bowls of dumpling soup in front of Humphrey and Clive.
Cheap and easily replaced chopsticks were the primary utensil in the Delta and most of Old City, but Humphrey grew up with silverware. Jason had been amused to discover the most common utensil in the high society was the spork. They chattered lightly over their lunch. Their empty dishes were taken away and replaced with a tray of fried, sticky rice cake.
"So what did you really want to talk about?" Humphrey asked.
"I'm guessing you didn't just call us out for lunch, excellent as it was." "I have a contract," Jason said. "2-star. They won't let me take it without a minimum team of 3.
"Minimum team?" Clive asked. "That means the danger is either large or unknown."
Humphrey's face darkened.
"Unknown usually means it's killed an adventurer already."
"That's right," Jason said. "A solo adventurer took a 1-star contract for something called a marsh worm. The tracking on his badge recorded his death mid-afternoon the day before yesterday." All 3 men looked down soberly. They were all adventurers, and even the less active Clive knew that death was always a possibility.
"All right then," Clive said. "So the job is to find the body and clear the monster?"
"Yeah, that's the job," Jason said. "Kill the monster and find the body. If nothing's left, then we at least bring back the badge."
"Not much to return to the family," Humphrey said, "but better than nothing."
"I looked up the marsh worm," Jason said, "and whatever's out there, I don't think it's that."
"No surprise there," Humphrey said. "Monsters don't always turn out to be what they're reported as."
"What does your ability say?" Clive asked Jason. "It says the monster that killed him," Jason said, "which doesn't tell us what it is, but means there should only be the one. Quest, contract, fallen comrade. An adventurer has fallen in the course of their duties. Complete their task and bring home their remains. Objective, eliminate the monster that killed your fellow adventurer. 0 of 1. Objective, retrieve the remains of your fellow adventurer. 0 of 1.
"It could be a lot of things," Humphrey said. "There are quite a few giant worm and serpent-type monsters that appear in the Delta."
"There are a few that could be mistaken for a marsh worm," Clive said, "at least by someone who didn't really know monsters. Most people only know monsters that commonly spawn in their area, and usually by description. Most run before they ever get a good look."
"If it took down an adventurer already, we can't dismiss the danger," Humphrey said. "Any monster strong enough to take down someone who went looking for a marsh worm alone will be at the top of the Iron Rank power scale, or maybe even bronze. It won't be some lesser elemental that anyone could punch apart with sufficient determination."
"Not all Iron Rank monsters were created equal. Their rank was a function of their magical density, not actual power. If bronze rank damage reduction and resistances were ignored, the most powerful Iron Rank monsters were stronger than the weaker bronze examples. The difference was usually made up in numbers, with weaker monsters appearing in greater numbers."
"So," Jason said, "are you in?"
"Of course," Humphrey said.
Clive nodded. "It could be any of us, someday. If it's me, I hope I'm not left at the bottom of a bog somewhere. Do you know anything about the adventurer?"
Jason nodded. "I asked Vincent about him."
"I'd like to hear it," Humphrey said.
Sophie stood under the shower in Jory's clinic. Designed to wash less able patients, the shower had no walls or curtains and was open to the room. Arms out in front of her, hands against the wall, she leaned forward, letting the water spray down onto the back of her head and neck. After several of Jory's strongest potions, spaced out to prevent toxicity, all that remained of her injuries was the blood the shower was sluicing off her body. When she emerged, wearing spare clothes provided by Jory, the alchemist shoved a large bottle full of red liquid into her hands.
"Drink it," he said, bluntly.
"Now."
"What is it?"
"It will stop your blood from responding to tracking abilities," he said. "I made it up while you were getting clean." She looked at Belinda standing behind him.
"What did you tell him?" Sophie asked her.
"Don't tell me anything," Jory said. "Then I don't have to lie if it comes to that." Sophie looked down at the bottle in her hands.
"If I wanted to deal with you," Jory said,
All I had to do was not help you. Drink it, before whoever did that to you arrives at my door.
Drink it, Soph, Belinda said. We need to get moving.
She frowned at the bottle, but drained it dry.
Let's go, Lindy.
Sophie made for the back door, Belinda in tow. Belinda stopped at the door, looking back at Jory, still standing in the hall. Their eyes met, and his hard expression softened at the apology in hers.
Wait,
he said, ducking through a door and coming back with a leather satchel, which he handed to Belinda.
Just some random medical supplies, he said. It's all labeled.
She gave him a sad smile as she took the bag.
Thank you,
she told him, then walked out the door. On the top floor of the Adventure Society's administration building, the director's office occupied a large space in the corner of the building, the windows giving a panoramic view of the campus grounds. The director, Elspeth Arella, was looking out those windows as one of her officials made a report. Her name was Genevieve, and Jason would recognize her as the elderly elf who questioned him during his promotion hearing.
Lord Vordis is refusing to say what the package contained, beyond that it was very valuable.
And the guards who set the ambush, Arella said. They were from the Duke's household guard?
Yes, Genevieve said. 6 bronze rankers and triple that in iron ranks.
And she still got away, Arella chuckled. The Duke won't like how that makes his forces look. This thief is a resourceful girl, lucky for us. Set up a meeting with the Duke. I want to be very clear that the moment he fobbed this issue onto us, it became an Adventure Society concern. He can't take it back now.
He's already sent a preemptive response, Genevieve said.
I'll bet he has, Arella said.
He claims that since you have failed to complete the contract after the better part of 2 months, and refused to raise the contract to the bronze rank level, then he is duty-bound as the city ruler to intervene.
Send our response when you set up the meeting, Arella said. Make it clear that he is the one that placed this issue in the hands of the Adventure Society,